The title of today's message is just a standalone message before we get started next week. The title is, I Can't Take It Anymore! Now, what I'd like to do is talk about suffering. About 10 years ago, I had a very good friend of mine that lost her husband in a scuba diving accident. And I spent a lot of time trying to help this mother and these four kids survive that. I was at their house every day for about 30 days. And it was a tough go at that house. But the predominant, the preeminent question that the mother asked me, and we talked about over and over and over again, was, she said, you know, Seth, I know you tell me God loves me. But if he loves me, why so much, why didn't he prevent this suffering? Why didn't he prevent this accident from occurring? Why did he leave four children without a father? And I can tell you, in my many times over there, I would have given my right arm to come up with a satisfactory explanation of why that happened. But you know, when somebody is in the middle of suffering, though they ask the question why, the last thing they want is an explanation. I had all kinds of explanations running through my head, truths out of Scripture, that in another day, later, after suffering is it's through suffering, start to make sense. But at the moment, those kinds of truths sound like cliches, and they really sound like sort of sword thrusts right into the heart. 1 Peter 1, 5 and 6 says, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice. Then notice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. If you want a good little book to read about suffering, 1 Peter is a great book. 5 little chapters, but it's chock full of good stuff on suffering. But one of the things that's intriguing to me that he says here is that you've had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. You know, when you go through suffering, it doesn't have to be a biggie for it to be suffering. It doesn't have to be cancer. A bad toothache will suffice. It doesn't have to be the finality of a divorce. A lonely spouse will suffice. It doesn't have to be that you bury one of your kids, but walking through time, extended times, of their foolish choices will suffice. It doesn't have to be just the biggies for it to be suffering. There are four questions I'd like to briefly look at today. The first question is, why doesn't God explain himself in my suffering? A minute ago, I was mentioning that I had all kinds of things running through my head that I wanted to share with my friend, but at the time, those things were not good to share right then, right in the midst of suffering. Like, I wanted to say something like, well, you know, God is able to bring good out of even the worst tragedy. Or, there are a lot of kids that never have a dad. And at least your kids got to have a dad for a number of years. Or somehow God is going to walk you through this. God can use all of this for good. I wanted to say those things, but all of those things are the last thing you want to hear when you're in the midst of suffering. You know, suffering is sort of like an injury. When you get injured, the last thing you want your doctor to do is explain to you the process of how you got injured. You don't want your mother giving you a lecture about how stupid you were that you got injured. If you have an injury, what you want is not immediate explanation, but immediate care. When I was in grad school, I was up all night studying for a final. It was 6 in the morning, and I stood on a desk near a window to look up at this little spider and his spider web. You know, after you've been up all night, anything is intriguing. And I had to stand up and stay awake for my 8 o'clock final. This little spider had killed a bunch of moths, and after it, you know, sucked the life out of them, dropped them out of the net, down out of their web, down onto the floor. And I was just fascinated by all the moths that were there. And I saw a spider up there, and I thought, I'd like to see this in action. So I picked up a dead moth, stood up on one of those, you know, those little school desks, you know, with the chair and the wraparound thing, and I stood up on the chair, and then I stood up on the desk part, plopped the little thing into the web, and the little spider came out and started doing his work. I thought, wow, not sufficient to see this once. I had to see it twice. Picked up another moth, stood on the chair, stood on the desk, and this time when I plopped it into the web, the desk went like this, and I went flying into the third-story window. I landed in the window, and I had a cut on my left knee that went through the skin, the muscle, and the tendon all the way to the bone. It looked like you'd been to the grocery store and you were buying hamburger meat. It was awful. I hobbled down the dorm to my room, and my roommate had just gotten up. And I walked in trying to hold all of this together, and I went and I got up on the little sink and started just washing cold water over it. And my roommate, I mean, if you know me at all, you'll understand what he's, "All right, Gatchel, what did you do this time?" He thought I was just pulling a practical joke on him. I said, "No, I really messed myself up here." And after we did the water, it was a big cut. Off to the emergency room we went. Now, the emergency room in those days was not like today. We actually got in to the emergency room without much of a wait. The last thing I needed from my doctor was to tell me about traumatic piercing injuries or the physiological explanations for blood loss. I just needed him to sew all that stuff up. I didn't need immediate explanations. I needed immediate care. Now, you and I know that. As much as we know that, God knows that a whole lot more when you and I go through suffering. You can ask him all you want to explain why in the world this is happening, but in my experience, most of the time, he's going to be silent because he knows that no explanation is going to suffice when you are in the midst of suffering. It would be cruel to give an explanation in the midst of. Instead, what he does so often, he does so well, is he promises to comfort us and to get us through suffering. And he is really, really good at that. He promises to comfort and get us through it. Isaiah 66 says, "As a mother comforts her child, so will I comfort you, and you will be comforted over Jerusalem." Now, I mentioned that God promises to get us through suffering. And that word "through" is important. He doesn't promise to alleviate our suffering or to stop our suffering or necessarily to keep us from suffering. We have no guarantee on any of those things. But he does promise to walk us through our suffering. There's something that you and I, and really everybody, just needs to accept about life and about God. He allows really horrible things to occur. Evil dictators rise to power and commit genocide. Earthquakes and hurricanes and tsunamis happen and ravage the land and devastate villages. Sometimes rapists and murderers, it's a long time before they're caught and brought to justice. And sometime in this life, some of them go scot-free. That's the world we live in. 1 Peter 4:12 says that should not surprise us. He says, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering." Problem is, we are surprised when we go through painful. "Don't be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you." You don't have to think about this. All you have to do is think about Jesus Christ on the night he was arrested, the night before he was crucified. He goes to the Garden of Eden at night to pray. I mean, the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. And in that garden, he prays this particular prayer. Let's go on to the next. There we go. "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup be taken away from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." It's a good prayer. Good prayer that if you've ever been through in a trial, probably a prayer you've prayed. It's the equivalent of the 11th hour plea. The call from the lawyer to the governor at 11:45, hoping for the stay of execution. And the message gets to heaven, and the reply comes back, "Request denied." Now, if Jesus Christ himself is going to go through that kind of horrible suffering, Why should we be surprised when we go through all kinds of awful suffering? 1 Corinthians 10:13 says, "No temptation has overtaken you that is common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your strength, but will provide a way of escape so you can endure it." A way of escape is an important phrase in this particular verse. As we think about this, normally this verse is always related to temptation. When you and I go through temptation, there's some great promises in here. All the temptations we go through are not unique to you. They're common to everyone. He will not let you be tempted beyond your strength. It may feel like it or seem like it sometime, but he'll not let this happen. He provides a way of escape so you can endure temptation. You say, well, Seth, this verse doesn't have anything to do with suffering. It has to do with temptation. Well, think for a second. When you go through suffering, what are you tempted to do? I think most of us are tempted with one thing, hopelessness. Hopelessness. And that's a temptation when you're in the midst of suffering to buy into pretty easily. What he promises here is a way of escape, not from suffering, but through suffering. You might think of a way of escape as like a secret hatch on a submarine that allows you to escape. If the submarine's on fire and you're up on the level of the ocean, you can open the escape hatch and you can escape the flames. Well, think about Jesus in Gethsemane. God said, no, request denied. This is something you have to go through. We're going to go through this together. But the second thing God did was he immediately dispatched an angel to Gethsemane, to Jesus, and he was with him side by side to strengthen him and restore him and give him resolve and courage to face the next roughly 24 hours. He does the same with you and I. He promises to walk us through times of suffering. Look on the inside of your handout. 1 Peter 5 says, "The God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast." That's a promise. One of the great poems ever written in the English language is the poem Footprints, Footprints in the Sand. I hesitated even used to talk about this because it's so well known. But it is such a great story, and it so fits this, I thought, why not? A man at the end of his life, as the poem says, looks back on his life in reflection, and he looks back on a scene something like this, and he sees two sets of footprints all through his life. And as he reflects on that, he thinks that God has walked with him through all of the events of his life. But upon further reflection, he sees that there are some times where instead of two sets of footprints, there's only one. And he looks a little more closely at those, and he notices that every time there's one set of footprints, those were the events in his life that were the absolute hardest, the times of suffering. And he questions. He says, God, why did you leave me in the hardest time of my suffering? Why did you abandon me? I had to walk through this all alone. And the father says, my son, I did not abandon you. During those times, I picked you up and I carried you through. Now, one of the reasons why that poem so resonates over the last 70 years since it was written is it because virtually every believer can think back about times where that was like how it was for you. It may seem like you were all alone at the time, and God was a million miles away, but as you got through the time of suffering and looked back, you could see, yes, somehow, some way, God got me through this. And you marvel at that. Psalm 77, God uses the same image here. Your path led through the sea, your way through the mighty waters, though your footprints were not seen. Now, as good as an illustration, Footprints in the Sand is, it fails in one particular aspect of going through suffering. It implies that God does all the work and all you have to do is just kind of sit in his arms and let him walk. And that's really not the case. There is an escape hatch. There's something for you to do. There are times you have to reach up and grab that escape hatch and turn the handle and swivel it off and pull yourself up on the deck of the submarine, so to speak. But when you're going through suffering, it's very easy not to utilize the escape hatch God gives to you. Oftentimes, when people go through suffering, they do things like this. They quit going to church. They quit reading their Bible. They quit going to small group. They quit being out with people. They just sort of pull in and hide all by themselves. Even failing to respond to the people God sends their way. And you know, over a period of time, when you have removed yourself from the escape hatches that God has provided, when you go through a time of suffering, it will seem like you're overwhelmed or seem like the situation is hopeless, even when that escape hatch is staring you right in the face. How should we think about suffering? Second question. How should we think as we're going through suffering? One of the hardest questions that we tackled in seminary and theology class was, why would an all-good and all-powerful deity, God, allow anybody to suffer? And the question is really simple. If God was all-good and he allowed suffering, he must not be all-powerful. And if God was all-powerful and he could keep suffering from happening, then he must not be all-good. That was the question. I'd like to say one thing about this in terms of how we think about life when we're suffering. It's in your handout. There is something terribly wrong with this life. There is something terribly wrong with this life. And I don't mean that life is just good and bad. There's just right and wrong. Sometimes life is cool and sometimes life is hard. I'm saying that it's something different from that. There is something that is off about life. There is something skewed about life. Or life doesn't make sense. There's something terribly wrong with life. Let's say this afternoon you decide to go down to the beach. You go down to Corona Del Mar. You take your kids down there. You do a hot dog cookout. Your kids play in the waves. If there's some sun, you soak it in. If you stay long enough, you'll see a beautiful sunset. Enjoy the majesty of the waves crashing on the beach. But let's say on the way home, you're involved in a terrible car accident. They have to take your kid to the emergency room. And all of a sudden, your kid that was playing in the waves in the afternoon is now sharing a room with a cancer patient. And instead of having some floaties on their arms, they've got drip lines into their arms. That's the world we live in. C.S. Lewis said it best. We as people know that everything that is good in this world is really too good. And everything that is bad in this world is really too bad. Everybody knows intuitively that what is good is supposed to be here and has every right to be here, and what is bad should not be here and has no right to be here whatsoever. That's the world we live in. Something is terribly wrong with this life. Sometimes you hear people say, you know, well, death is just a part of life. It's just a normal part of life. And there's a theological word explanation for that. Phooey! It may be a fact of life, but it was certainly not intended to be a part of this life. It was not intended to be natural nor normal when God set up this world. As you think about life, the question to ask is, what's wrong with this picture? And in your handout, let's go to the next one. I might have skipped it. Is there one right before that? I skipped it. Well, just write this in. What's wrong with this picture of life? The picture is wrong because something went wrong. The picture is wrong because something went wrong. Back when Adam and Eve were first made and they were living in the Garden of Eden, God gave them a perfect environment, a good, perfectly good environment in which to live. They had everything. No disease, no death, no marital conflicts, not even any mother-in-laws. Not that I'm referring to any mother-in-law in particular. But with everything around them that was good, they committed a brazen act of treachery. They looked God in the face and they said, "You're holding out on us. We don't have everything that there is to experience. How come?" And they questioned God. And even though God warned them not to do this, they brazenly went ahead and disobeyed. Genesis 2 says, "You must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good." And you might want to underline these next two words. "And evil." "You must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will die." Now, what had there been experienced so far? Their experience had been the land of good. And they said, "That's not enough. You're holding out on us. We want something more." And in their arrogance and in their rebellion, they thumbed their nose at God and they went ahead and they ate that fruit anyway. Now you might say, "Well, what's so wrong about eating the fruit?" God had given them everything out of His goodness to enjoy. And that should have been plenty and sufficient. They should have been deliriously happy. And instead they got mad as a hornet. And they said, we want to know everything. We don't want you to determine what's good and what's bad. We don't want you to determine what we are to do or not to do. We don't want anybody to tell us what to do. And they disobeyed. They ate the fruit. And they discovered the knowledge of good and evil. And they discovered that in spades. Expelled out of the Garden of Eden, never to return again, they entered this world. And now, every one of us have done the same thing they did. Don't want anybody to tell me what to do, not even God. I'm going to determine what's right and wrong. I'm going to be the captain of my soul. If you tell me to do something different than what I want to do, tough luck. And we live in a world of good and evil. Awful good and awful evil. Now, this might be a little hard to understand, but it really shouldn't be if you're the parent of a teenager. If you have younger kids, you're already at work on this. One of your greatest fears is that your kid or kids are going to discover a part of this world that they shouldn't have to discover personally. You don't want them to get in with the wrong crowd. You don't want them to get into the whole drugs and alcohol and prostitution and all the different things that are out there. You work hard to keep them from that. And you've told your kids countless times, you'll be sorry if you enter over into this world. It's going to hit you with a vengeance. It's going to come back and smack you. And you're going to regret being over there. But let's say, in spite of all of your efforts to convince your 16-year-old son or daughter that you don't want to go over there, let's say at age 16, they say to you, "I've had it. I'm tired of living by your rules. I want to live by my rules. And my friends drink and they get into cocaine and look how happy they are." In spite of having a roof over their head, a room, clothes in the closet, all kinds of tennis shoes, perhaps car privileges, the love of father and mother, they say, "To hell with you. I'm going to live life like I want to." They thumb their nose at you. "I don't need you or what you have to give me." And out the door they go. You know what they discover? They discover exactly what Adam and Eve discovered. The knowledge of good and evil. And all of a sudden, their friends that they thought they had are the kind of people that steal them blind when they can for drug money or beat the hell out of them. They discover that cocaine might be free at the beginning, but at the end, it's a terrible taskmaster. And it will rob them of everything that's important over time. Now, you never intended for that to happen. You didn't want it to happen. You did everything within your power to keep it from happening. If that 16-year-old son or daughter says, "That's what I'm going to do, to hell with you," Out of the garden they go. Out of your home they go. This is what Adam and Eve did. Third question, why doesn't God prevent suffering? That's the question my friend asked me on countless occasions. As you've probably noticed, God doesn't superimpose his will on our human will very often. We like to claim that we want to be free. Well, nobody appreciates freedom more than God. It's just the right kind of freedom. Galatians 6 says, "Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. The one who sows to please his sinful nature, from that nature will reap destruction. The one who sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life." God gives you freedom to choose however you want to. He's not going to intervene. Rarely does he seem to intervene to keep us from our stupid choices and the suffering we bring upon ourselves and others. But there's another reason why God doesn't prevent suffering, and this is hard for our proud human nature to accept. We need suffering. Every one of us. Talk about politically incorrect. Isaiah 26, speaking to God, he says, "When your judgments come upon the earth, the people of the world learn righteousness." We've had massive earthquakes in China. Massive storms in Myanmar, what used to be Burma. Some tornadoes over the weekend in the Midwest. Those things go on all the time. And people look at those and they say, "Where was God? How come he didn't do something?" As if people are right and God is wrong. Here, Isaiah says, when your judgments come upon the earth, look at the amazing thing that happens. The people of the world learn righteousness. We wake up, at least some do, and they say, "I can't live just as I want to and expect there aren't going to be consequences. I don't live in that kind of world." Though grace is shown to the wicked, which is what a lot of people want. Why can't God just be kind and nice? Here's the reason. Though grace is shown to the wicked, they do not learn righteousness. That doesn't work. Just like it doesn't work with your teenagers or your little 2 or 3 year olds. They need spankings. And so do we. Even in a land of uprightness, they go on doing evil and regard not the majesty of the Lord. Why doesn't God prevent suffering? Because he's given us choice and because we need suffering. The last question, where is God when I suffer? Where is God when I suffer? And the simple answer is with you. It's easy to think that God has left, when in reality, think about what happened after the Garden of Eden. Immediately, a plan went into effect at the end of Genesis 3, and the whole Bible is the outlay of that plan, where God decided, instead of abandoning us to that world of evil, letting us be on our own, "If you want to live that way, fine," he could have said. The whole Bible is a plan of his intervention into our world, intervening himself, culminating in the birth of a baby who we call Jesus, growing up a sinless life and allowing himself to be persecuted, tortured, and finally killed on a cross. We call that the incarnation. You know, one of the things that's just amazing to me about the cross is it shows us the extent to which God will go to intervene in our suffering, even at his own peril. It doesn't take a theologian to realize that there's something wondrous about a father who sacrifices his life for his children. And that's the story of the gospel. You know, when you think about other world religions and how they think about suffering, you know, in my opinion, some of these things are just absolute nonsense. You talk to people who believe in Islam, and the first thing they'll tell you about suffering is, "You just need to accept the will of Allah." That really doesn't help me all that much when I'm going through suffering. Or Orthodox Judaism, you ask them and you say, it's wrong to question God. That doesn't help me either when I'm going through suffering. When I'm going through suffering, I got a lot of questions for God. They're not good questions. They're not right questions. But I still got a lot of questions. Or you take Buddhism. Buddhism says, well, you wouldn't suffer so much if you didn't desire so much. And so there's sort of this detachment principle. If you detach yourself from the things you want, the things you think you should have, remove yourself from them. When you don't get them, you won't suffer so much. That's like junior high theology. I remember thinking like that when I was in eighth grade. Christianity says something very different. When we go through suffering, God says to us, I want you to trust me with your suffering, and I'm going to jump in the pool with you in your suffering. I'm going to be with you. Hebrews 2:18 says, because he himself suffered when he was being tempted, he is able to help those who are tempted. Because Jesus Christ suffered, he's able to identify with you and to walk with us. When I was a little boy, I remember my mother taking me to the pool to teach me how to swim. And I remember I was not a happy participant. I was not a happy pupil. I saw enough little kids screaming bloody murder at the pool. I knew something was wrong with this whole picture. She finally got me in the pool. And I was willing to hang on to that edge for dear life. I was even willing to hold on to the edge and do the little flutter kick thing as long as I could keep my head up. I would even hold on with one hand and do one arm like this and then another arm. I was willing to do all that. But the one thing I would absolutely refuse to do was to put my head underwater, because I had seen enough little kids just like me who did that, and they come up spittering water and sputtering and resolved never to do that again. I may look stupid, but I'm not stupid. My mother was just a genius. At one point, she just looked at me and she said, Seth, watch me. She's in the pool with me. She said, Seth, watch me. And she came up smiling. Ding! Something different is possible. That's what God does. That's what the whole incarnation is. Jesus Christ coming in the flesh. Except he didn't just jump into our pool. He jumped into our cesspool. And took the worst that this life had to throw at him. Hebrews 13:12 says, and so Jesus also suffered outside the city gate, this is the cross, to make the people holy through his own blood. Anyway, think about this. I think about, it's easy to look and say, well, you know, God didn't have all that much to do with this. Jesus is the one that took all the brunt and the trauma and the suffering. It's easy to say that if you've never lost a child. If you know somebody's lost a child, you would never say those words about God the Father and what he suffered in watching all of this play out with his sinless son. I've watched atheists go through suffering, and I've watched committed Christians go through suffering. And you know what? It seems like, in general, we all go through suffering. The amounts may differ. But there's one thing that I have noticed between most atheists and most committed Christians when they go through suffering, and that the Christian has the opportunity to go through suffering with hope. Hope that my suffering, even though I can't see why in the world I'm going through this, has meaning to God, and one day I'll understand something of that meaning. That suffering in some way is going to be redemptive. That our redemptive God is going to use that in my life and in the lives of other people. The hope that I am going to get through this. He's going to walk me through this. And the hope that I am going to know God a whole lot better by the time this particular episode of suffering is over than I did when I started. And I've had some opportunities. The most recent one with, you know, being diagnosed with cancer about almost 2 years ago. Sometimes it's your greatest fear. But you know what? God's used that in my life. Our redemptive God. Hebrews 2:10 says, in bringing many sons to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through him everything exists, should make the author, meaning Jesus, of their salvation perfect through suffering. If that happens even to him, don't be surprised when it happens to you. And if some of you happen to be at this moment in the pit of despair, going through your own story time of suffering, I can promise you something. God's going to find you. He's going to be standing right behind you. He's going to be calling your name. He's going to want you to turn around. He offers to lift you up, to carry you through, to comfort you, and for the opportunity to know him better than you ever would have known him apart from this particular episode of suffering. And when he says, I know what you're going through, that will encourage you, because he knows what it's like to be nailed to a cross. He knows what it's like to be reviled and rejected. He knows what it's like to die. He knows what it's like to be buried in a cold, dark tomb. But he also knows what it's like to stand again and rise out of that tomb. Kenny, would you come up? I asked Kenny to share something of his story as it relates to suffering. Come on up, buddy.
Testing. All right. My name's Kenny. If you don't know me, married to Monica over there, father of four daughters. And the other day, Seth asked me to share on my suffering, and I said, sure, why not? Then I thought about it, and I thought, wow, I'm going to go up there and reveal myself before our congregation and the things that I've gone through. And it was really about talking with God and saying, you know, how can I glorify you in all this, God? And so I'm going to attempt to do that right here. Grew up somewhat of a crazy childhood. It's really hard to explain, but it was just pretty insane. In eighth grade, my parents decided to get divorced. And I remember my mom coming home from school, my mom saying, having her bags all packed right there. And she goes, you know, me and your dad are getting divorced. I'm leaving. When your dad gets home, tell him to pack his bags and leave. So she took her bags, got in the car, and left. And we're all sitting there pretty nervous to talk to dad, you know, about that. And he gets home, and we explain that to him. And he packs his bags and leaves. What we didn't realize is that nobody was coming back. And so for the next few years, in fact, we didn't see either one of them for about a year, which made Christmas really weird. But they just decided to pack it up and quit. And as children, that was pretty hard to fathom and to go through. I remember being very scared and just hurt and those type of things. But I remember it really going to anger, moving into kind of the anger issue. And at that point, I sought any relief I could from feeling that kind of thing in my life. Of my parents were alcoholics, so, you know, drinking was definitely in the ballpark for not feeling what you're going through. I used work, of sports, alcohol, drugs, and just about every vice known to man that I could not feel that incident. And in fact, it got so bad that I figured by the time I was 25, I wasn't going to be around. In fact, I remember somewhere in the 20s just remembering that I wasn't going to pay taxes anymore. I figured, you know, why pay taxes? I'm not going to be here when they come to collect. Well, I hit 25, and I remember having to go down to the IRS and explain that to them. And talk about your suffering. And in fact, I've considered that with the whole rapture thing and running up some credit, but it didn't work out so good the first time. I just figured I'd pass that. But that continued on for about 30 years, that suffering. Of 20 years into it, I became a Christian, and there was hope. And I could see this. And it was all good, except, man, I just kept feeling that suffering. I just kept that part of me was still in me, that darkness in me. Because I had become, by doing all those other things, I had become just like my dad was. I was a scoundrel. You know, it was my will, the way I wanted to do things, my choices, they were just killing me. They were emptying me inside. And the harder part was as a Christian, I figured, well, it's all going to be great. It's all gone. Now it's all groovy. And it really wasn't like that. What it really was is God allowing me to start seeing myself in all of this. Prior to that point, it was easy enough to point fingers, and this is why I do what I do. But suddenly, you know, I came to that point that, wow, I was just the same creature. And that, I ran from that for a while. And I remember coming to the point where I was done, that I could run no longer, could hide no longer, really didn't care to hide. I was at a point where, you know, this is it, God, we're just done. And I the day came, I remember just being so broken and empty inside, and it was raining, and I was laying in my driveway, rain coming down on me. And I told God, I said, you know, I'm done. Here's my life, completely surrendered to you. I've got nothing left. And I wept bitterly. And I got to be honest, that was probably the first time that I really had cried about it all. The whole life just poured out right there. And, you know, in Psalm 51, somewhere in here, I had that marked. There we go. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth will declare your praise. You do not delight in sacrifice, or I would bring it. You do not take pleasure in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, you will not despise. And that was kind of the point I had reached, is I had reached a broken heart to him, a contrite heart. I was willing to pretty much just have what God would have for me at that point. And the strangest thing happened is that God really revealed his truth to my mind. As I lay there, I could see my sin as clear as day and who I was as a person and what had become. You know, that initial act of somebody else's screwballness had set me on a path to wreak havoc and, you know, disaster in my own life and many other lives that I touched. And when I looked at it, I was just like my dad was. You know, I would abandon my family and take other routes. But I could see God at that point too, through it all. I could see where he had protected me to even keep me alive to that point, to come to that thing. I could see his hand of provision. You know, as kids, it's pretty hard to provide for yourselves. And yet somehow we had a roof over our head and food on the table. And we were able to provide and those things. I could see his mercy and his grace. I could see my father. And I could see his sin and his suffering. And I could see that his pride had kept him living in darkness his whole life. And it was, it's still there. You know, I could see that there was really no one to blame, no one to point the finger for my sin any longer. And, you know, it was at that point that I was given hope. Because I could really see that God cared for me and loved me and brought me all this way. And, you know, my tears changed. They were no longer tears of bitterness, but tears of joy. Because I felt a change in my heart. I can't explain it. You know, God's pretty miraculous in what he does, but he had changed my heart. I could look back at my life and even look forward to my life and see that there was hope and there was freedom from that. And even though that had occurred, it no longer held me in its bondage. And at that point, I praise God. And Psalm 40 here is a great, great verse. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cries. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and the mire. He set my feet upon a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth and a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Thank you.